One, two, three, four. Jake and Jonathan. Jake and Jonathan. Jake and Jonathan. Jake and Jonathan. Whoa, Jake and Jonathan. Yeah. Lee John Zaratsky. Once again, my very special co-host is John Zaratsky. Jonathan Courtney is on vacation, and replacing him more than ably, I would say, is my good friend, John Zaratsky, co-author on our New York Times best-selling book, Sprint and Make Time, and a former designer at Feedburner, which was acquired by Google, designer at YouTube, design partner Google Ventures. He's done a lot of stuff, and he's a nice guy. John, thanks for being here.
I just keep showing up, and we just keep recording. So I hope it's not awkward when Jonathan gets back.
Well, it's always awkward one way or another.
That's what the people come for.
Today, later in the podcast, we have an interview for you.
Yeah, it's a special treat.
It's a special treat. The guest, I'll let John tell you more about the guest when the time comes. But I will give one spoiler, which is that the guest does a bit of swearing, and the guest felt kind of bad about swearing, which is pretty funny because Jonathan Courtney normally almost no words that aren't swears. It's almost all swears when he's on. So you've cleaned things up considerably, John, in your time.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing I brought in a foul-mouthed guest.
a ringer.
And rebalance the cuss levels. Sounds kind of gross. Cuss level.
Hey, everybody. It's Jake and John from the future. I forgot to include this little ad when we started recording the podcast, so we'll just make it nice and short and sweet.
Through the magic of technology.
Through the magic of technology. Jace has stitched this into the beginning of the podcast. We are doing some online boot camps. John and I together teaching the design sprint, and you can learn more at thesprintbook.com/bootcamp. Did I get that right, John?
You got that right. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a series. We're doing a limited engagement of official Jake and Jay-Z sprint boot camps.
Oh, yeah. It's like that stadium concert tour, but just with like a few people on Zoom. But it'll be but cooler than that sounded.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, check it out. thesprintbook.com/bootcamp.
See you there.
And now, Jace, if you'd play a little sound to take us back to the regular recording. How's your week been?
It's been good. The last couple of weeks have been like weeks where things did not really go according to plan. Not for any like super bad reason, but just like, you know, weird things came up.
Yeah.
And this week it feels like things are like, so far, you know, we're at Wednesday, we're recording this, feels like things are like pretty locked in. So that's always a good feeling, you know, to have like a week where I'm able to get the things done that I want to get done. And then it's almost Labor Day weekend, which is a holiday in the US. So going to be taking off a little bit early on Friday and taking yet another COVID-cation, driving to a remote location where there are not a lot of people, and hanging out with my family, my parents, my sister, brother-in-law, and my wife, Michelle, of course. Little brother, August, his girlfriend, Karina, and probably some other extended family members in Green Lake, Wisconsin, where I grew up. So looking forward to that.
Your hometown. Now I'm just back from my hometown as well.
Yeah.
Orcas Island, Washington, and we did some camping there, and then we got scared away from the camping because it's too hard to sleep. It's so hard to sleep in a tent.
Yeah, and then it just goes downhill, you know? You get behind on the sleep, and then you don't have a good day, and then
you're
cranky because you're not sleeping, and then...
Yeah, I was like, why am I so tired and angry? And I normally am kind of tired and angry, but it was a lot. So, so it does feel good to have a week where you're just on track. So I'm hoping today is the start of that week for me. Oh, I know what. I need to read this email. We got one email about the podcast with you and me in it. And it says, Team Jake scores big. This is from Noel. And Noel says, Hi, Jake, longtime listener, first time emailer, Seattle native. This last episode was among the best yet. The Jake Knapp / John Zaratsky combo was a welcome refresh of design wisdom, good looks, and improvised podcast gold. As an aside, this is not in the email, but John, if you don't understand the good looks comment, you should listen to the episode the last episode with Jonathan before your episode.
Okay.
You might want to listen to part of that. So we spent most of the time, Jonathan and I, talking about how handsome you are. So this is related to,
wow,
related to that. So
that's quite embarrassing, actually.
I know. It's very embarrassing, yeah. So I won't go into any more detail now. This last episode is among the best yet. Jake Knapp, John Zaraski combos a welcome refresh of design wisdom, good looks, and improvised podcast gold. A huge blow for Team Jonathan. Can they recover? So I like that. I enjoyed that email a lot. I thought I would read it out loud to you.
Yeah, that's really nice. Is that the only email that you have received about this?
Yeah, yeah. Man. I don't really know how much the level of feedback from listeners relates to how many people are listening. It might be that Noel's the only person listening and he's super, and engagement is 100%. It might be that most people who listen to a podcast would never think of writing in an email, which is where I am. I'm probably in that in that category.
Yeah.
I don't know. If you're, hey, listeners right now, if you want it, you can email me, hey@jakeknapp.com. You know, let us know what you think or just say hi, whatever.
It's funny because I have never emailed a podcast host, but for some reason, when I think about podcasts, I just assume that they get a lot of email. I don't know. It's a clear contradiction in my own thought patterns.
Well, when you're thinking about podcasts, you're thinking about big shots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about like Tim Ferriss's email inbox. And yeah.
So
I don't think the guy's even looked at email in like the last 10 years.
Yeah. I think that the cool thing about podcasts is that we can all kind of feel a little bit like, well, now I'm in the same category as everyone else who has a podcast. But this is not like that if you're listening. I love that phrase, if you're listening. I mean, obviously you're listening if you heard it. You don't have to say it. But yeah, anyone, and this goes to you too, John, anyone can email me and I'll read
it. You could be just reading the transcript, which could would be
that's
probably pretty bad.
That's, yeah.
Probably not an enjoyable experience.
Definitely would be bad.
That reminds me, sorry, no. My turn for a quick aside. I was a guest on a podcast recently.
Oh, yeah.
The host, he like sent me a little video clip that I could put on LinkedIn to promote it, which I like to do because I generally, you know, I like to help the podcast host by promoting it, but I don't always know what to say about it other than like, hey, I was on this podcast.
Yeah.
So I like it when people give me like a clip or, you know, a little video, or even if they do a post and I can just reshare it or retweet it. Anyway, so I get the video, I look at it, and he like overlaid the captions on the bottom, which is great.
Yeah.
People don't have to turn on audio, whatever. I don't know if I talk this way all the time or just in this one clip, but I said like every third word was like.
Oh,
I just did
man.
It again right now.
Yeah.
It was very embarrassing. And I think that in other cases, maybe people who have produced transcripts have edited out a lot of the filler words, but this guy did not. He kept them all in there. It was word for word. And it was kind of embarrassing.
I am horrified when I see a transcript of myself talking. Even if it, you know, like you can do, I just said like again, you can do it on Google Meet, does like live.
Right.
So it's even there or like whatever. It is shocking how poorly constructed the sentences are. And like everything, it's just, it's an abomination. But you know what? Actually, this came up today. I was talking to my friend Aaron, on whose podcast I'm going to be. We were actually recording a podcast. This makes it sound like you and I are on podcasts all the time, but like it's almost never, except for this podcast. But it did happen to be that today I did one. And he introduced me to this quote by Steve Jobs, which I will see if I can find here real quick, because it's from a speech. And so the quote, so I'm going to read you verbatim. This is from Goodreads. I don't know if it's 100% accurate, but it's the first result for this quote. It's a good quote, by the way, but the way it's phrased, it's obvious that he was speaking, and I think that's interesting. So he says, when you grow up, you tend to get told that the world is the way it is, and your life is just to live your life inside the world. Try not to bash into the walls too much. Try to have a nice family life, have fun, save a little money. That's a very limited life. Life can be much broader once you discover one simple fact. Everything around you that you call life was made up by people that were no smarter than you, and you can change it. You can influence it. Once you learn that, you'll never be the same again. I mean, it's a great quote that I think has a lot of alignment with the idea of defaults that we talk about. I was like,
totally,
it's a great quote. But the beginning of it, it's very like he says, when you grow up, you tend to get told that the world is the way it is, and your life is just to live your life inside the world. And it's like, unless they mistyped it, you know, it's just like, it's just the way people talk. I often read these quotes by Pete Carroll, who's the, you know, the coach of the Seahawks.
Yeah.
I mean, you read his quotes and you understand what he's saying, but like, it's just barely comprehensible. But it's funny how, I don't know how much we pick up from the intonation, how much we pick up from the context, the tone that's coming across from people. But I think it's actually, I mean, you're one of the people who I think is the most well-formed in your speech. So if you think that is a problem, God, help the rest of us.
That's actually one of the frustrations that I've had with this life of kind of being a creator, you know, having a personal brand, sort of being like, I don't even know what to call it, but you know what I mean? Like being a person who like has to continually kind of build and reinforce a public persona in order to sell books and things like that.
Yeah. You're a talking head.
Yeah. One of the things that I found frustrating about that is the performance nature of it, because even when you're in an ostensibly non-performative context, like a podcast where you're just chatting, you're still performing. And there are so many ways in which that performance gets like distilled and chopped up and edited and transcribed. And
yeah.
Like, it just, to me, it takes a thing that's already, at least for me, at being sort of a, not a natural performer, sort of an introverted person, it takes this thing that's already hard and really dials up the stakes, really raises the stakes because, and I try not to think about it too much, but I do know and I do continue to be sort of intimidated by the knowledge that if I say something on a podcast, not only does it need to be interesting and because somebody's listening to it, but if it gets turned into a video with a transcription and then it gets shared, and it's like, oh my God, what if I said like too many times? You know, what if I, what if it took me 15 seconds to warm up to get to the point? Like, is anybody going to watch through that part of the video? I don't know. I'm probably overthinking it, but it's...
I think you are, because I think the reality is nobody cares about 99.999% of the content that's out there. And
yeah, that's true.
When they are listening to the podcast, which is, you know, the bulk of the people who will ever listen to this, my God, they're emptying the garbage out in the alley right now. And I don't know if you can hear it, but it sounds like they're
I thought that was what the podcast listeners, you were saying, I thought you were saying yeah, that like, no. They've got their headphones in. They're like, I'll just put on this dumb podcast where I take the trash out. And they can't even hear what we're saying anyway, because there's like dumpsters banging around.
They probably can't, right? It's probably true.
No, but you broke the fourth wall and there was actually, trash was being taken out.
There is actual garbage. it's so loud. So, you know, people are just like, they're not paying attention to, I mean, that's the thing. Like, nobody really is like reading quotes by us if they hear one. But I do always get annoyed when I see a quote, if I see something that I said in speech written down, I'm like, God, what a moron. I think part of it too is that in many contexts, you and I are trying to craft words.
Right.
You know, like we're editing something, or like you and I might be going back editing something and like trying to wordsmith something. And then when I see something that I just came out of my mouth, it's like, oh God, like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess people just don't care. Do you hear the garbage? I mean,
I was like, I heard a little something.
Okay. But it's more loud to me, I guess.
Yeah.
The directional microphone probably takes care of a lot of it.
Yeah.
There's some good street sounds in the interview later on.
Yeah, totally.
Although they sound more cool. They sound more like the cool kind of interview. I mean, the garbage truck sounds are kind of like wonka, 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 wonka. And then like air brakes, like, it's not, the ones later are more like wah wah wah, like the, you know, the car horn, or like which is more like cool city vibes.
Actually, I have a very strange like memory and association with garbage pickup noises, and here it is. When I was in college, I grew up in a very small town of 1,000 people, rural, not much going on. My high school class had like 32 kids in it. And I went to college at University of Wisconsin in Madison, which is a city of like 250,000 people. It's probably bigger now, but at the time it was like maybe 250,000. And it was the first time I had lived in a city. You know, I maybe spent like one night in a hotel, like in Chicago or in Milwaukee or something before that. But I never lived in a city. And I remember like the freshman year I lived in the dorms, and then sophomore year I got an apartment with a friend of mine, and it was like in sort of the downtown part of Madison where, like, you know, classic urban living, you can walk out your front door and go grab a coffee, you know, whatever. and they would pick up the garbage at like probably 6 a.m, which if when you're in college, might as well be the middle of the night, you know, because I was definitely still sleeping. And at first when it would happen, I was like, this is so annoying. Like, this is the worst thing ever. And then I don't know what changed, but I somehow changed my mindset about that. And I decided that that was like, that I appreciated hearing that noise because it like, it gave me this sort of cozy contentment about living in the city. And like, I'm like tucked into bed in like my apartment downtown and like the city noises are going on around me. And I don't know, that's my weird story about garbage noises, but it like, to this day, it is like, I associate it with like this cool feeling of like being sort of grown up and living in a city.
The soothing sound of garbage.
Yeah.
Which could be the tagline for this podcast, I think.
Going at this rate, it might have to be.
In your hometown, do you have to take the garbage to the dump?
That's a good question. My dad does. So my parents still live in Green Lake.
Yeah.
And my dad does take the garbage to the dump, but I don't know if it's because he has to or because he just likes to.
I wonder how many of our listeners are familiar with taking stuff to the dump as like the regular way that you take the garbage, but it's actually surprisingly fun because that's what you have to do in the small town where I grew up. And you throw the garbage in the garbage bin, right? Well, yeah, I suppose they have to be open. And then there's this thing at the dump on Orcas Island where I grew up, this little island where they call it the exchange. So you take stuff that's like maybe has some life left in it and you give it to them and then they sell it for like whatever. Basically, it's like a bar, like whatever people want to pay for it, they can pay for it. And you just have to come to an agreement with the person who's working at the front of the exchange. Mm. And that's been there forever.
But it
burned down a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you can't imagine what that fire must have been like. And they have everything there. You know, they have clothes, but they have books and they have, you know, parts from cars and furniture, just like whatever garbage that might not be garbage. And then it burned down, but then they rebuilt it. And it's like actually like this like really nice building. Like they got really into it. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
But cool.
God, what are we, man? I wanted to ask you, I don't know. Okay, do we have enough time? Do we not have enough time to do anything else? Should we get into the interview?
According to my computer, we've been talking for 19 minutes.
Okay. What was our goal? I forgot.
I think it was 10.
Oh, jeez. Okay. We'll do it another time. All right. We'll do it another time. We'll do it another time.
Should we introduce our very special guest?
Yeah, we should. So tell me a little bit about, who is our guest?
Yeah, this was a real treat. I had the opportunity to interview Ruben Flores Martinez, who is the CEO and founder of a company called CashDrop, which makes it really easy for any business owner to set up like a storefront. So I don't know if people have heard of like Gumroad, which was like a startup that sort of lets you do that, but that's much more for like selling digital things, Venmo and like the Cash App. And there's like kind of all these different technologies and ways of, you know, being able to sell things online. But sort of the insight that Ruben had was that if you're running like a physical business, like a business that sells things, products, food, drinks, it's like really hard to get set up to sell. There's great tools these days, like for sure. There's, you know, Shopify and like, you know, there's great stuff out there. It's still like pretty tough. There's like, it takes you a while. Like if you've never done it before, like imagine you've been running a restaurant for 20 years and all of a sudden it's like COVID-19 pandemic and you're like, oh my God, how do I take online orders? Like I have literally never had to do that before. It can be pretty intimidating. So he had this idea to create this thing that would allow you to just set up a storefront, super easy. List your products, people could pay. Ruben is a designer and he's a developer. He's an entrepreneur and he's got a cool story. He was born and raised in Mexico. He talks about that a bit in the interview. He came to the US when he was, I think, like 12 or 13 with his parents. They moved to Milwaukee from Guadalajara, Mexico. He went to a high school called Riverside University High School, which is very close to where I live in Milwaukee. He, according to his LinkedIn, he was the valedictorian of his high school class. When he started applying for colleges, he realized that he was undocumented and he didn't have a social security number. He couldn't get into college. And so he's now a citizen. He has navigated those waters, but part of his mission, in addition to helping businesses like get set up to be e-commerce businesses using CashDrop, his mission is also to help other immigrants have access to the opportunity to become entrepreneurs and to build things and to work in technology. And so we talked a lot about that. And so I guess I'll stop yammering about our interview and we'll just cut to it.
If you want to check out Ruben's company, it's getcashdrop.com. Very beautifully designed website, by the way.
So you grew up here, at least like part of your childhood, right? In Milwaukee?
Yeah. So my family moved to Milwaukee when I was 13 years old.
And you guys came here from Mexico, right?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Guadalajara, Mexico. Fairly large city, maybe 5 million people. So it's the second largest city in Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were very advanced chemical engineering degrees.
Oh, cool.
But there was just no opportunity. So
yeah,
my family was forced to immigrate to Milwaukee. My parents came here not to work, you know, their degrees. They kept, my mom was a cashier at a bakery for 10 years.
Yeah.
My dad was like a landscaping man at this big building downtown.
Yeah.
But they did what they had to be done for the family. So
yeah,
that's definitely, I wear that very proud on my chest every single day.
Yeah.
Just like that engine, you know.
How do they feel about all your success and how things are going now with Cash Drop?
I mean, they probably have no fucking clue what I do, honestly. I think the cool thing to me is that I know in my heart that no matter what, my parents are already proud of me. So I'm already successful in their eyes.
Yeah.
And I think that that helps me whenever I get in moments of doubt or mm-hmm. when I even get too deep in my head, I'm like, A, you have nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Nothing to fear. Your mom already thinks you made it and that's all that matters. B, no matter how big you make it in this game, it's nothing compared to the sacrifice they made for you.
Yeah.
So check yourself. So it's a good balance in action, you know?
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people feel pressure that, you know, is based on their relationship with their parents, either for good reason or not for good reasons. You know, maybe there's no reason to feel that way. But for you to have kind of that like knowledge that they are proud of you no matter what, and you're not trying to live up to some goal that you believe they have set for you, but that you're already good enough and successful enough. That's pretty powerful.
It's freeing, you know, because it just kind of lowers the expectations.
Yeah.
And I was talking to one of my mentors the other day, like saying, like, what makes a great founder? And I said, the ingredients for a great founder is A, they come from nothing. B, they have nothing to lose. C, they give zero fucks. Right. And like when you kind of bring that together, I think that that creates a really good mix.
Yeah. No kidding. I'm glad we were recording that part because that's.
I hope this is. Yeah. Sorry, I curse a lot, so maybe I should check my.
No, I don't think so. I think I'm a guest host for this podcast, so as far as I'm concerned, we can say whatever we want. We don't have to deal with the ramifications.
Okay. Awesome. We're in yeah. HBO. We're in HBO.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, we've been recording, but thanks for joining us. I first heard about you or became aware of you because I saw a post on LinkedIn about the funding round that you raised. Like, was that just last month or earlier this month?
It's like 2 weeks ago and yeah. It was like 10 years ago, bro.
I know. I can't keep track of time, whether it's going fast or slow. But I was like, oh, that's really cool. That's interesting. I saw that you were in Chicago. I saw that you had lived in Milwaukee. And I clicked on your profile and we were already connected.
Yeah.
And we had like 47 connections in common. And I was like, what's the deal? Like, have we met or like, what do I know this guy? Or is it, you know, are we just, I guess like very free with our clicks of the connect button on
yeah,
LinkedIn?
Yeah, that's exact. So I had this thing when I moved to Chicago 3 years ago, like I didn't know anybody. And
yeah,
I had never been a LinkedIn person
yeah.
whatsoever, but I just kind of went there. I gave myself a nice title. And I just started making friends. And it's literally by virtue of going to that tab where just like tap and add people. And I just made it my thing where like whenever I had a minute down, I would just add people. And next thing you know, I have like 11,000 connections and I've never yeah. met any of them. It's really crazy that the best relationships that have ever happened or come across my way happened because of that.
Yeah.
Like the power of LinkedIn is real. It's really crazy. And you know, like, just start adding people, share your story, and somebody somewhere will listen to it. And next thing you know, that your advisor, then your mentor, next thing you know, they're putting in touch with, you know, Siam Bannister and Scott Belsky overnight. And you're like, yo, this is crazy. But
yeah,
you're two taps away from anybody you could ever meet. It's just more about like, what are you saying to the world
yeah.
that justifies their attention so that you can really say, look, I'm here to make a difference, right? Who out there believes what I believe? And that's a shit move.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
That's cool. Yeah. I think that LinkedIn has not, you know, it hasn't been considered like the cool platform for like startup people and
right.
and VCs or whatever, but it's kind of this like quiet giant, you know, where like you're saying, people have just sort of been amassing these connections and putting good things out into the world, and right. a lot of people are now seeing the rewards. So
I agree. It's way more useful than Twitter, by the way.
Yeah.
Twitter is just a cesspool of just trash. I'm not a Twitter person by any means.
Yeah. Yeah. I can relate. All right. So first thing I want to ask you about is, you know, a lot of the people listening to this podcast are designers, some product managers, some entrepreneurs, some engineers. Probably many of them have not heard of CashDrop. So can you just kind of explain what it is really briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. So CashDrop is a platform that enables people to create an online store in under 15 minutes, period. That's really how we saw the way that we can create an impact in this world, because we live in this era of the entrepreneur. Everybody mm-hmm. wants to be able to become an entrepreneur and take control over their destiny, right? And it's a very difficult process to get you to get started, to create a store, to go through the whole, like all of the hoops and all of the risk. And we just wanted to create something that almost was bridging that the simplicity and the ubiquity of, like, say, like a Venmo.
Yeah.
But in the back end had the power of a full POS system, a full Shopify-esque platform, where our job just becomes like, how can we make it easier, faster, cheaper, and better just to get people to go market, right? And really change and innovate beyond just the technology, but rather like the economics that power that technology, because that's always a really big piece of the experience. So we just came across and said, look, you download this, you go to market, you start that store in under 15 minutes. There's no paywall. There's no commissions, no monthly fees. Just get going.
Yeah.
And that's really the mission for us. It's just empowering dreamers, right? Like helping people turn their passions into money.
Yeah.
Helping people turn their ideas to a side hustle, to an eventual lifestyle. Like that's how we empower people and just give them access mm-hmm. to a technology that they don't have to look over their shoulders, mm-hmm. right? That they know they can rely on, and that they know that they can thrive on. And it's going to be there, very accessible for them.
Yeah. That's really cool. I've sort of picked up on this from reading some of your posts and some interviews that you've done. And I'm really interested in this idea that you have not just designed or redesigned sort of the product or, you know, the end user, the customer experience, but you've sort of redesigned the business model, and you've considered all these things about fees and transaction percentages and all that stuff. You've considered that as part of the user experience. And we have a lot of designers who are listening, and we talk a lot on this show about, you know, how products are designed and how various experiences are designed. But I'm wondering if you can share a bit about like your process as you were developing CashDrop. Like, how did you realize that you needed to redesign the economics of it, that you couldn't just focus on creating like yet another slick, easy to use digital storefront?
I'd like to say that CashDrop was definitely rooted in my childhood, but you know, one of my most formative childhood memories was this of a traveling flea market that would congregate outside of my door every Saturday. So like every Saturday at like 3 a.m, merchants from all over the city would come and congregate, claim a little piece of land, build a little tent with sticks and linens. And then like that was the infrastructure they needed to start a business.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me what happens when you really empower creatives and entrepreneurs with a very minimal, friction-free, very modular infrastructure where they really allow themselves to figure it out, right? Because it's very low risk. And you see people that were like, same people, same place, same tent, but their business could be 180 degrees every single Saturday until they found what worked, and they would adapt with the new hypes, with the new trends, the consumer demand shifts. And that always inspired me, because it's not like that currently. You put so much effort into launching something and you go through all these troubles, and the majority of these people, they're not tech savvy.
Yeah.
They know what they sell, but they don't know that all of the infrastructure and all the steps required to get you there. It feels like such a gigantic, you know, like mission that like it has to work. You can't change it.
Yeah.
And that was like that inspiration to me. Like there was something there, and I couldn't really fully understand it until I started building CashDrop, you know, a year ago. You know, our first birthday is next week, September 7th.
Yeah.
When my family immigrated to Milwaukee, I saw that same issue in a different kind of light where, you know, Milwaukee is a very service-driven town, right? A lot of my friends growing up were bartenders, servers, in the service industry. Mm-hmm. And you always almost saw this complete lack of trust that existed between the SMBs and the gigantic tech incumbents. Mm. And it almost seemed that a lot of these small merchants were forced to use solutions like Groupon, like OpenTable, not because they wanted to, but because they were being forced to and they didn't fall behind.
Yeah.
So when you really try to unpack like what, like the relationship that these people have with technology, I kind of had this key insight very quickly that it's like, it's not that the products aren't powerful enough. It's not that the products don't do what they're supposed to. It's that the implications and the cost of doing business with these platforms is pretty great. And it comes at a great cost. And it puts an unsustainable amount of burden on these platforms' own customers, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where you kind of get the Groupon effect. Like maybe in Chicago, you live in the land of Groupon, you see, you know, some of the great, but also a lot of the bad.
Yep.
And you kind of learn to see there was an economic thing. Like e-commerce has evolved so much in the last 20 years. When you think of Shopify, you think of e-commerce. When you think of e-commerce, you think of products that are shipped to you.
Yeah.
Also, but like it's evolved now where like Grubhub is a type of e-commerce.
Yeah.
Groupon is a type of e-commerce. And you kind of see these iterations and changes that happen all the time. But almost always you kind of see that the monetization tactics behind the scene have kind of stayed the same since the beginning of the internet.
Mm.
The internet economy hasn't really adapted to enable that next generation of businesses to thrive on in a new way. And to me, the future is microtransactions, right? Like, how do you, instead of putting an unsustainable amount of burn on one party, the merchant, what if you're able to amortize it across the greater population where everybody contributes a little bit, but at the end of the day, so long as that yields a better, faster, more convenient experience, and you know that that is inherently going to benefit that mom and pop shop business that you want to thrive, I think that that's where people open up to this idea that's like, you know, have you ever heard that saying that death and taxes are the only guarantees of life?
Yeah.
Death, taxes, and convenience fees are guarantees of life, right? So it's just a matter of like, how do we address this problem? There's a cost of doing business. Who pays for it and why? And ultimately, how do we kind of rebalance the scales to create a better ecosystem that benefits everybody? Particularly me, I don't want to live in a world where there's a Chick-fil-A at every corner, right?
Yeah.
Because all of this, the local players had to die and the corporate overlords come and buy everything, the pennies and the dollar,
right?
Because they were the ones that had the resources and the ability to create, you know, solutions that benefited them. Like, we just want to address that problem before it gets worse. And the irony is that the consumer is already kind of, it's paying for all these fees already. They're just, people are lying to the consumers. And you're lying to yourself if you don't think that when you order from Postmates, that you're not paying a 10% service fee, a 10% delivery fee, tip 15%, and then that you're paying inflated prices because the merchants need to offset the commissions. To us, it's just like, just take all the BS away. This is how it needs to be. But this is in efforts of creating a better way so that people everywhere can have access and the opportunity to thrive, the opportunity to create, and ultimately put food on the table for their families and put their dreams ahead and be able to become who they want, right? But being able to provide for the families. Like, that's the world we all want to live in. We all want to champion those stories. We all want to empower those entrepreneurs. And if that means me paying a 45-cent fee just so that I can get everything, you know, catered to me while I'm just browsing Instagram so that I get a text when it's ready, like, I'm willing to do that. I'm very passionate about that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But you see the devastation, man. Like, I would talk to so many merchants like that. They're so afraid of what happens if they don't adopt something. What happens if they do? And it's just like, can't win either way. You kind of feel like you're picking from the lesser of two evils. But like, when we really, we say, look, that's not what we're all about. We're here to empower you and just focus on making sure that you're thriving.
Yeah.
Magic happens. Like, they really start relying on it. They start really getting the benefits that they're supposed to from these platforms. And their business starts seeing these optimizations that end up making a massive change to their daily lives. And that's just beautiful to us to see every day.
Yeah. And adopting your product from a position of trust and transparency instead of businesses working with other larger companies and worrying about, you know, are our incentives aligned? Are they trying to screw me over? Like, are they going to change the rules in a way that's not going to be to my benefit? Like, that's a very scary and tenuous way to build a business. And building a business is already scary and tenuous.
Exactly.
So to be able to do that with you and do that in this way that is really based on trust and transparency, I think is, to me, it explains a lot about your success in the last few months.
Yeah, I think that that's our biggest core value, right? Like, just trust. Because that is the one thing that has been missing from big tech thus far.
Yeah.
And when you talk to venture capitalists, like, they'll be like, oh, SMBs are too hard. Like, we don't touch SMBs. it's hard to scale, it's hard to get them to do things. It's like, no, just change the game so you're not fucking them over every time.
Yeah.
Just have them rely on you such that not only are they using your product effectively and they become successful, they advocate for you.
Yeah, yeah.
This is why we've been able to scale all over the country and we haven't spent anything in marketing.
Yeah.
Because when you fundamentally create trust with people,
yeah,
those are the brands, I think, that are able to inspire the population.
Right.
They're able to kind of create this, like, these legends about them. Like, look, they're here to empower. They're here to help. Everybody should jump on this. Like, there's just no fear anymore. And that, I think, is what takes a brand from here to there.
Yeah.
When we think of Cash App to me is a consumer company. Insofar as that I know that I'm talking to everybody out there, and I know that there's a $1 million idea in everybody's head.
Right.
Right?
Because consumers are becoming entrepreneurs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We talk to everybody. This is not just about people that are in business. Like, this is about the next generation of what happens when you're seeing massive devastation. But with all this death, there comes life. Right? What are those next generation of businesses going to look like?
Yeah.
How are we going to look ahead and make sure that they are thriving such that in 2 years they become the incumbent in bigger, better, faster, better ways we never even thought possible?
Yeah.
And I think that that's what gets me so excited and pumped about it.
Yeah.
But I think it just becomes a universal language.
Yeah.
Because who doesn't want to better themselves for their family? Who isn't willing to do what it takes for those they love? That's what it means to be an entrepreneur, right? That's what it means to be an immigrant to me as well.
Yeah.
It's just like, you just want to constantly find ways of staying in control of your life, putting food on the table, and providing better opportunities for those you love. And that's what we're all about. And I think that when you tell that story, trust happens.
Yeah.
And then from trust becomes advocacy. And
yeah,
that's as much of a moat as you really need to have.
Right.
You know, like, we're not targeting this market saying that we are the most advanced platform, that we have the most facts and figures and features. It was never about that. Never. Mm-hmm. That never mattered to a small merchant. It matters, like, how are you going to come help me in my moment where everything is against me?
Mm.
How are you going to make sure that I stay in business and I can put food on the table, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're all about.
One of the things that I really like to ask entrepreneurs about is their mission and their vision. And those words often get used interchangeably. And I think there's a lot of love for vision. You know, there's a lot of love for this idea that you as a founder are going to have this brilliant picture in your head of what the world should look like. And you're going to go out and you're going to make it happen and you're going to build it. But I think that mission is way more important.
Way more important.
There's a clear, really clear sense of, you know, just hearing you talk and from the other stuff I've read about you, that you know what your mission is and you've known from the beginning. But I'm curious how your vision has changed at all. Like, from the moment you started building to the moment you launched, I think you launched in January, and then, you know, obviously the COVID pandemic began in March, and that's obviously changed everything. Like, your mission has stayed constant, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I wonder, like, has your vision, has the specific way that the product, the community, the business that you need to build to achieve that mission, has that changed over the last year?
It's definitely refined itself,
mm-hmm,
but it's kind of stayed the same, you know. And it's really funny because I was actually talking to an investor of mine as to, like, the first pitch deck that you put, just have this idea and you just put it down there.
Yeah.
And then, like, you try to show it to people and nobody gets it. And then you kind of like change it to try to tell a different story because you feel like what you had there is not it. And then you kind of find yourself going off for full circle and like, this was it all around.
Yeah.
It's kind of a little bit like that, right? Like,
sure,
we just kind of came and say, look, we want this to be the go-to platforms for entrepreneurs anywhere in the world to start any business in 15 minutes, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's too much fragmentation. There's too many different options there. It's too much work. Just mm-hmm, one place, one time, you know, like, just want to make some money, come to Cash App. We're going to teach you how to do it. You know, obviously, we kind of had this moment in food.
Yeah.
Where, like, product market fit just took us, and it's very self-evident there. But, you know, I've always been very good at just, like, making sure that I see almost like as restaurants to the books, as the books to Amazon, right? Like, it's there, it's very profitable. Like, we're making a really big impact, but still, like, how do you clear the path for us to say, look, this is how we proved ourselves to the world. This is how we introduced the brand, but we're telling this holistic story that can appeal to people in all walks of life, all verticals. And that's what stayed very consistent about the vision from day zero. It hasn't really changed for us.
Yeah. It's sort of like how, the idea of like a killer app, you know, like the Apple II, when it came out, like the killer app was VisiCalc. It's like one of the first spreadsheet apps. And so it was like, they had created this whole platform, this whole, you know, transformative thing in the Apple II, But at first, the reason that people used it was to get access to spreadsheets, you know, is to like have this amazing new thing. And that's kind of similar for you guys. Like you're building this, like this platform that will have the ability to transform how people start businesses. But at first, it's really, really good for restaurants and for like food service businesses. And that's kind of where you're like proving yourselves.
It kind of found its way, you know, there really quickly. We could have very quickly said, look, we want to be the best at that. You know, like we can compete with the best in that space. But to me, I've always been fascinated by this idea, right? I look at Shopify every day.
Mm-hmm.
They're a great company. People love them. They're a market darling. They're doing great.
Yeah.
You know, but I look at it from an evolutionary track. It's like we have to fundamentally believe that there's going to be something that's bigger, better, and just next wave than Shopify. It's just going to happen. It's a matter of when rather than if. And I have to fundamentally believe that that's Cash App to us.
Yeah.
And in order for you to create that vision of the world, you have to fundamentally understand, where is e-commerce going? What is that next generation of business looks like?
Yeah.
Where it's no longer, again, a ship of a product.
Right.
It could be an experience. It could be an order for food. It could be a digital asset. It could be me as a person.
Yeah. Like,
how do you teach people how to monetize the things that they never even thought were monetizable?
Yeah.
And how do you teach them to create, you know, and just put it out there and create a business for themselves? You know, like that's, I think, what the future of e-commerce looks like.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that that's always been the vision from day zero for us. But getting there, you know, you kind of have to pave your own path to get there. But when people ask me, like, are you a Grubhub competitor? Are you like a Ritual competitor? I'm like, no, like we're here to evolve and take the baton from Shopify. Like that's where I'm thinking.
Yeah.
That's our point. That's the North Star for us. And I think that that's where we fundamentally understand that our job is to help as many people, you know, in different walks of the world. And it's our responsibility to be able to create this infrastructure that can be very modularized and adaptable to so many different use cases. But when you really see that, there's like what I call the big five, right? They kind of encompass all of e-commerce as a whole. Like you have your Shopify's of the world, you have the Grubhub's of the world, you have the Groupon's of the world, the Booksy's of the world, and the Eventbrite's of the world. That right there kind of encompasses e-commerce as a whole.
Sure.
You know, we're just trying to kind of bring it together into a more digestible package, right? That's targeted at that next generation of kids that are going to look and be like, I'm a great gamer, but like nobody believes that this could be a skill. Nobody thinks this is a valuable skill, but guess what? Maybe you can do a link drop and drop your own version of Masterclass and put it out for selling. Guess what? Millions of people all over the world will probably pay for that. Next thing you know, you're a $1 million business when nobody thought you had anything, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a product anymore. It's about the drive that you have to find ways to make money. And that's where we inject ourselves. That's what Cash App's here to do.
You've had a lot of success with like restaurants and other kind of food service businesses. I know that you know, what you were just saying, you're sort of interested in empowering all kinds of entrepreneurs, but like, is there a specific next sector or specific type of business that you're really, really excited about helping next?
You know, it's funny because we're kind of growing all over the place. We have a very eclectic ecosystem of merchants. Like we have, we just recently had an account in Alaska. She's a girl that does custom calligraphy stuff and she launched a Cash App store. We have somebody else that does like accessories. We have like barbers that are like ditching books and using Cash App because they like the idea of like doing their calendar, but they also want to drop swag and they want to drop like different things.
Yeah.
We have like cloud grocery stores, like, you know, one of the largest seafood and produce suppliers in Illinois, the owner's son went to one of our restaurants and he was like, holy shit, if we could have this in our vertical to go direct to consumer, it'd be game changing. Guess what? He went home, downloaded the app, cloud grocery store overnight, and he's been taking orders ever since.
Huh.
You know, we had Goose Island, they had a beer delivery truck. You know, we have some really cool stories of like, somebody in Madison, there was a bartender that got laid off and had like absolutely no income, but he was like an artist by trade. And one day he's like, you know, chilling in his house. He comes up with this really cool design that could be a t-shirt. But guess what? He has no income. He doesn't even have any ability to produce the shirts.
Yeah.
And he thought it was just a pipe dream.
Yeah.
Guess what? He downloads Cash App. He puts it up for sale. Fast forward a week later, he makes $600 and he used that money to produce the shirts.
Cool.
Fast forward 2 months later, he's got an entire clothing line.
Amazing.
Hoodies and pants and shorts.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's kind of growing, but I think where we kind of bring it back, I think Cash App is really going to thrive in the intersection of what I believe where culture happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, culture happens at the intersection of food, fashion, and beauty. Because those three things just are everything to us, right?
Yeah.
And I think if you can create an ecosystem around it and really encompass all of that commerce around it, where it's one place that has the ability to really, you know, transform all of those, I think that that's where you create something that people really care about.
Yeah.
You know, and it just tells this very compelling story. And then from there, it can go into more niche things. But to us, in terms of strategic resource deployment, we're starting with food and we're starting to analyze, you know, the services industries. You know, we're starting to analyze all of these, you know, the retail industries, because the incumbents in those places have very high friction barriers to entry for people, whether it's because of cost or hardware, or because it is about fees and like long-term economics.
Yep.
Like, we really think that we can create something that can be very, very competitive on these three spaces by telling the same story we've been telling with food.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same story at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. It's really cool to hear you talk about friction.
Yeah.
I'm like weirdly obsessed with friction because I think it explains so much about behavior. Like, it can be used to, you know, you remove friction to make it easier to do things, but you can also intentionally or unintentionally add friction to things to make you less likely to do something. And that's something that, like, Jake and I wrote this book called Make Time that's all about ways of kind of structuring your day and your time around the work that you want to be doing instead of being stuck in those reactive loops on Twitter or on Instagram, whatever.
Right.
And friction is like really important to modifying your own personal behavior to say, like, okay, you want to spend less time on Twitter? Well, maybe take the app off your phone or maybe log out of the app. So there's just like a little bit more friction. And so I love hearing you talk about friction when it comes to entrepreneurship and just understanding where the current sources of friction come from, because they come from everywhere. They come from like these very like small things of like taking fees or charging too much money for services or whatever, but they also come from these very, very like top-down structural elements of, you know, the way that distribution channels work or the way that funding channels work. And they create so much friction that people who might otherwise have an amazing business that they want to build,
they never do.
They can't. Yeah. It's like that path is totally closed to them.
100%. I mean, my take on the issue is that Silicon Valley thus far has taken a very privileged approach to commerce, and we failed to understand. And it is something that I saw in my community. I come to learn, you know, that me being a venture-backed Latino founder, right? Like, only 1% of all VC goes to Latino founders, right?
The
stacks are already stacked up against us.
Right.
But also, when you really learn to see the community that I come from, being an entrepreneur is a gift. It's a blessing.
Yeah.
It's not something that anybody just gets to wake up every day and be like, I'm just going to become an entrepreneur. I have this million-dollar idea. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
It's because all of these hoops and all of these paths and all of this friction, they'll just slowly but surely just deter it to a point where, like, yeah, it's a pipe dream, but that's not for me.
Right.
It's for somebody else. And that's a massive problem because, to your point, we are sitting in this massive untapped potential of millions of people all over the world, starting with America, right? We have this innovation problem, right? Innovation doesn't only mean technology, right? It could be in all sectors.
Yeah.
And we're not really doing anything to remove friction, to lower barriers, to break the walls and create longer tables, to make it more accessible for people to be able to become an entrepreneur and try it out. Because it's not about success, right? Like, it's about trying it out. You don't know. But if you make it low risk enough where you lost nothing and at best it becomes something, at worst, you just try something else until you find it, it hasn't been done yet. It just hasn't. And I think if we can wake up one day and see, like, wow, we inspired a whole generation of kids that didn't know how they were going to actually, you know, create a business or make a name for themselves. And they feel like they were being forced to go down these pipelines that they just fundamentally did not believe in.
Yeah.
That's how you change the world. That's how you make an impact. And you just empower that next generation to take control of their destinies. And that's what ultimately drives me at the end of the day. You know, I said this other day to an investor and I said, look, success is a mindset. And that mindset is powered by purpose. And if you don't wake up every day and have a clear sense of what you're doing to better somebody else's life, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't mean anything, why would people advocate for you? Why would people care? Why would they share their story? Why would they help you scale it so that I don't have to hire 1,000 people? Brands that have to sell, it's because they didn't do it right. They didn't create trust.
Yeah.
They created too much friction. Right. Now they have to sell themselves. And I think we're kind of just flipping that game on it, says like, and say, what if we were able to think completely different and completely turn those tables around and create sustainability and just trust? And I think that that's what happens. Like, I think that we can get to this point where we can scale very large and have a very lean team because the advocacy that we're able to pull from us, it's almost even unmatched from anything else that I've come to contact with.
Yeah, that's amazing. I want to ask you about something that's related to your team and to scaling. So you raised your first round of funding earlier this year, or like you said, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. Seems like it was a long time ago. I was reading a story about it, and I think it was on the website Built in Chicago. And there's just a quote, and not a quote from you, but a line in the story that caught my attention. Maybe it's not accurate, but if it is accurate, I think it's really interesting, and I want to ask you about it. It said that the company, and I'm reading from the story, the company plans to spend the funds on hiring about 7 content creators and growth executives. And so I wonder, like, is that accurate? And if so, like, that is very interesting to me, like this idea of really investing in content, which I assume means sort of investing in stories and sort of building that platform for advocacy so that you can scale. But I could be way off base on that. So what are your plans? Like, how are you going to scale while staying lean? And how do you see the kind of the team evolving over the next year or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the line was basically spot on. Like, where we really see where we need to invest in. We happen to have a very technically inclined team, right? Like, I'm a technical founder. You know, the relationship that I have with my CTO, like, we can complete each other's code. And that's very hard to find in the tech world.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But I, like, I
sorry to interrupt you for a second. How did you and your co-founder meet?
We met in college, actually, just way back.
Oh, cool.
You know, we're best friends since like 10 years ago. He is one of the most talented, just raw, empowered engineers I've ever met.
Yeah.
And I kind of dabble more into like the product design.
Sure.
You know, so we've just been working long enough today, which just make a lot of sense. Like for him to just be able to like quit his job and come in full turkey. And like, he already knew what needs to be done. We're already kind of going, you know?
Yeah.
So that's been really helpful because it just allows us to, you know, have this instantaneous feedback loop to our customers. That's something that I'm obsessed about.
Yep.
Because I am a product iteration machine by just, that's my superpower.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be on Instagram ranting and then merchants will be like, hey, can we move this from here to here? It'd be cool if we could do this. Like, give me 10 minutes, fam. I'm on it. You know, and we'll live tweak the product. So I think to us, and like, again, like the product will only move the needle so much. I think it just needs the substance to really leverage these networks that exist already to just massively turn the faucet on overnight without you having to blow millions and millions and millions of dollars into just intangibles that you can't really measure and you're just hoping that sticks, right? Everybody's kind of chasing for that viral effect.
Yeah.
But it's really not that hard. Like, just create something people like and have a very compelling story as to why that matters to them.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what everything happens. And I think that we are in this very special position as a tech company where I fundamentally believe like the brands, the tech companies that are able to like just create massive growth are the ones that can balance between media and technology. And when you marry the two, you're able to tell a compelling story and have a product that it doesn't have to be the most feature advanced. It just has to do what it does very well and just fast and convenient. When you kind of marry that with a story, it's magical. Right. So to us, it's like, we have both of those things. Right. And we have the technological prowess to keep it growing and adapted very quickly with a very minimal infrastructure. Whereas now, like, we should just shift gears into telling the story, telling the story, telling the story. Because when you plant it and people catch it, it gets the viral loop going for us. Where, because we just become such an integral piece of the merchant's marketing, the marketing spine, where they're driving. It's not that they're pushing us, they're pushing their business.
Right.
But now they're doing it in a more free form that they trust. And they're talking about it, and they're talking about it, and they're talking about it. And then their competitors see it, their peers see it, and they're like, what am I missing out on? Oh, shit, it's an app I can set up in 15 minutes. Oh, it doesn't cost me anything to get started. Say less, I'm going to try it. And then next day they go live, and it's just the same thing over and over and over.
Yeah.
So to us, it's like, we need to kind of champion these narratives. You know, what one of my investors, Michelle Fung, calls the Cinderella stories.
Yeah.
Like, what is like that value that we're providing so much so that we're able to optimize a business and just change the game for them in ways that they even thought possible.
Yeah.
And those are the stories that you focus on. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, when you really throw it all away and start from scratch and you rebase the ecosystem of how it functions and how it monetizes it, you just kind of a new set of problems and you have a new set of opportunities as well.
Sure.
Right. And you start seeing that those, when you really just encompass that and just push it out into the world, push it out into the world, it sells itself.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to try too hard. Like, we don't have to. My sales cycle is virtually instantaneous because they have this free to download. There's no monthly fees, no commissions. Just get started. How can we help you get selling today? right? So if we really master that, we take a lot of pride in that customer success piece. Right? Like, look, yeah. Come to the family. We'll help you out. We'll make sure that you're successful. We'll give you everything you need. What is it? Content, swag, stickers? Like, that doesn't matter to us. Our goal is for you to take control of your business and feel like you're in control in this, where there's so much uncertainty in the world, to the point where you're going to feel like you're thriving, where you're going to be able to expand,
yeah.
Where you're going to be able to like really push the bounds of what you thought your business was by virtue of saying, you know what, I'm going to try something different. I'm going to open up an entire new business by virtue of just doing a new drop. It's the same kitchen, same location, but I'm just going to think about it as something completely different.
Yeah.
And you can try and deploy and try and deploy. We don't have to do anything but just showcase that.
Yeah, totally.
And once you showcase that and people see that, it goes from there.
Yeah.
So going back full circle, content and growth is where it's at for us. More yeah. content than anything.
Totally.
Story wins, man, all the time. Yeah.
Well, like one of the reasons there's been so many big technology companies built is that technology is a multiplier.
Right.
It creates leverage, but it's not the only way to create leverage. Like stories are multipliers. Communities are multipliers.
They're more effective. Yeah. I think they're even more effective. Like, because at the end of the day, what remains? The legends, the stories that we yeah, tell each other, right? Like that's what creates this transgenerational shift for people to be like, yeah. wow, what? It's a feeling. It always comes down to a feeling.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Simon Sinek fan, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, people don't start buy what why. You do. They buy why you do it.
Totally. Right?
And absolutely. When you really inspire yeah. people to action, to better yep. themselves, and you paint that picture to them of what it could be.
Yeah.
And it's within their reach, within their means, where there's no longer about fear and uncertainty and friction.
Yeah.
Something triggers where like, what's my fucking excuse?
Right.
And then you just do it and magic happens. Man.
Yeah. No worries. Well, I think we should wrap up here. This has been awesome. Thank you so much, Ruben, and congratulations.
Thank you.
It's been super cool to like to follow your story from afar and now to get to hear some of it firsthand. So if anybody who's listening wants to check out what you're working on, what's the best place for them to find you?
Instagram. So it's cashdrop.biz. Our website is getcashdrop.com. But listen, I'm glued to my phone. I get all the messages.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Like till 2 days ago, you could literally have the app and like the support button would send me a text message directly. Now yeah. I need a new phone number and new inbox, but that's what I'm here for. So
yeah, right. Yeah. So being close to the customer feedback and, yeah. and you know, being able to make those quick product changes.
So yeah, send us a DM. Feel free. You know, we're looking to make friends and just keep the ball rolling.
Well, I think we talk a lot about design sprints. And we talk a lot about ways to prototype new ideas before committing to, you know, making huge investments in them on this podcast. And I think people are going to be really interested in that idea of like, if you have this idea for a different business or a different way of selling what you do, you can just set up a new drop. You can, you know, sort of reconfigure, reposition, re-merchandise things that you're doing.
Yeah.
And maybe the same team, same facility, same, like you said, same kitchen, same software, whatever it is that you have as your infrastructure, that stuff may be all the same. But this idea of being able to rapidly prototype and test with live customers in the market, that's really, really powerful.
Right.
I think people are going to dig that ability.
It's like marrying the VC and the entrepreneur into like entrepreneurs can now become almost like venture capitalists. Like you're just putting right. and deploying totally. And testing. And I yeah. think that that's what leads to greatness.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks again, Ruben. It was great to chat with you and enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. I appreciate you. Have a great day.
Hey, it's Jake again. There was another ad I was going to include that I forgot. So Make Time. Me and John's book, Make Time, is for sale in the UK. On Amazon, the Kindle version is just $1.99 for a limited time. So yeah, if you're in the UK and you got a Kindle, or I don't know, any device that can do Kindle stuff, go to Amazon and check it out. It's bad for us if you do it because we're never going to get any royalties if people buy it for $1.99. But you should do it. Take advantage and grab Make Time. And I hope you enjoy it. On with the podcast. Hey, thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We will be back next week. John Zaratsky will be with us again.
Still here.
Yeah. And again, you can email us with any thoughts because I guess we'll read emails on the air. Who knows? hey@jakeknapp.com. Thanks for listening.
As long as we are not overwhelmed by a flood of listening yeah, emails. I mean, we might like it. We might secretly be wishing for it.
Hasn't happened. Okay. So, all right. I'll see you now. Are you going to join me in singing that or are you going to keep just listening to me do it?
I'm just going to keep listening.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Jake and Jonathan. Jake and Jonathan. Actually, John Zaratsky. Actually, John Zaratsky. Jake and John Zaratsky, the podcast. Jake and John Zaratsky, the podcast. Jake and John Zaratsky, the podcast. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
See ya.